Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, an exhibition of photographs from 1970 showing George Harrison in Deerfield Beach at a pivotal point in his career is back on display.
With all the things going on in his life, this truly was the only time that he could exhale and reflect on everything. You know, he got to be with his family.
We'll discuss historical archaeology of 16th century La Florida,
the single Florida site verified as a location where the DeSoto expedition was present, was excavated at the Governor Martin site in Tallahassee.
And we'll go to the reenactment of the Battle of Camp Monroe. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. The exhibition George Was Here, The Best Kept Secret in Deerfield Beach, features 18 rare photographs of George Harrison visiting relatives in Deerfield Beach in 1970. The visit came just after the dissolution of the Beatles and just before the release of Harrison's most popular solo album, All Things Must Pass. Jeff Fisk from the Deerfield Beach Historical Society explains Harrison's familial ties to the area.
His mother's youngest brother, Edmund Eddie French, him and his family moved to Canada first from England. And then in 1967, the same year when my family moved to Deerfield Beach, he moved here. And soon after bought an apartment building right off of 81A and lived here until he passed in 1987. George's mom had passed away in July of 1970. And as far as our research has told us, his uncle, her little brother, did not make it to the funeral. So this was the first time that he actually got to see his aunt and uncle and two cousins, you know, since his mom's passing.
The 2021 Peter Jackson documentary, The Beatles, Get Back, shows the collapse of the Beatles as they wrote and recorded the Let It Be album in 1969. George Harrison was clearly no longer happy being a Beatle and had to be convinced to keep working with the band. The Beatles broke up in 1970, and George Harrison's most popular and critically acclaimed album, All Things Must Pass, came out in November of that year. As Deerfield Beach photographer Tom Craig explains, it was just before All Things Must Pass came out that Harrison vacationed in Florida.
A week to days before the album and the single was released, we believe he was here in Deerfield on this vacation with family. And as best we can tell from our research, this time period of 2 weeks was all that we can find that he had during that year for any type of time off.
The album All Things Must Pass contains Harrison's biggest solo hit, My Sweet Lord, and features guest performers including Eric Clapton, Ringo Starr, and Alan White. The album was co-produced by Phil Spector. Jeff Fisk says that Harrison's three-disc solo album finally brought him out from behind the shadow of songwriting duo John Lennon and Paul McCartney.
He had all these songs stored up and was regulated to basically two on a couple albums, three songs, but and a lot of the songs that were on the first two LPs of this triple set were songs that the Beatles, both Paul and John said, no, we don't think they're good enough. And actually, there was one interaction with the three of them. Ringo was in a in the hospital recovering from an illness. And Paul basically told George that the songs were not good enough. So for him, this was total vindication.
In 1976, a court ruled that George Harrison subconsciously plagiarized the Chiffon song He's So Fine when writing My Sweet Lord, but it remains his most popular solo song. Jeff Fisk explains where the photographs in the George Was Here exhibition came from.
This young girl at the time, Lynn Radigan, she had got a tip that he was in town and where he was, and she went over to the house and just knocked on the door of the apartment or the apartment building, and Patty Boyd answered, and she said, "I'd like to meet George Harrison." And Patty said, "Okay, I'll go get him," and brought him out. They sat out in the courtyard for almost 3 hours. Her father came and took photos and film. We don't have the film. We wish we did. And actually, her mom and dad became friends with his aunt and uncle the rest of their lives. But these 18 photos were the photos that her dad took during that meeting out in the courtyard.
Jeff Fisk is director of the Deerfield Beach Historical Society. We also spoke with photographer Tom Craig, who digitized and restored the 1970 photos for display. The exhibition George Was Here, The Best Kept Secret in Deerfield Beach, can be seen at the Cultural Center Thursday evenings from 5 to 8 and Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. through March 21st. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. It's all right. It's all right. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find out about our upcoming public history forum in Daytona Beach. More information and registration is at myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, the 2013 special issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly celebrated the 500th anniversary of the landing of Juan Ponce de Leon on the Florida Peninsula and his naming of the area as La Florida. Kathleen A. Deegan, a leading archaeologist on the Spanish colonial period and a distinguished research curator at the Florida Museum of Natural History, contributed an article on historical archaeology of the period.
From the outset, Deegan makes the complex world of historical archaeology accessible to all readers, starting with a definition of the term. Historical archaeology is a study of the past through the integration of material remains, stratigraphic contexts, and written documents. In other words, historical archaeologists study the location of artifacts in the layers of the soil and the physical remains in the context of written documents that describe the events that occurred in the area under excavation. She reminds us that the very notion of La Florida is, quote, "a completely European-imposed geographical idea, and assumes a post-1513 chronology and a spatial boundary that would have been quite alien to the indigenous people who live there," end quote. Even the Spanish idea of Florida's geography veers dramatically from our own. In the 16th century, La Florida extended northward from the Florida Keys to an ill-defined point north of the Chesapeake Bay, and westward from the Atlantic Ocean to at least the Mississippi River. Initially, historical archaeology in La Florida was restricted to the peninsula, but focused on indigenous sites post-1513. In 1945, John W. Griffin proposed an agenda for historical archaeology that called for, quote, a closer collaboration between historians and archaeologists in understanding location, dates, and societies of native sites in the historic period, end quote. Hale G. Smith's 1956 book, European and the Indian, followed this agenda. Deegan follows a well-organized agenda of her own in her discussion on 16th century historical archaeology, dividing the material into distinct periods and activities, exploration, failed settlements, colonization, and first missions in the hinterland. By avoiding the strict chronological organization, she circumvents confusion over intersecting sequences of events.
Connie, Deegan asserts that there were multiple explorations and attempts to conquer La Florida in the first half of the 16th century, but she focuses on routes traversed by Hernando de Soto across the southeastern area and the impact of Spanish expeditions on indigenous people.
The single Florida site verified as a location where the De Soto expedition was present was excavated at the Governor Martin site in Tallahassee. The expedition chose the site, which was near an Appalachian town, for its encampment during the winter of 1539 and 1540. A second site on the eastern shore of Orange Lake wetlands near Citra yielded artifacts, although they may represent the Native American trade routes rather than the presence of De Soto. Although the general path of the expedition is known, archaeologists debate the details of the route the nomadic expedition followed. The most important Native American site associated with the expedition is the Tatham Mound in Citrus County. Excavated in 1985-1986, the mound yielded skeleton remains of 339 post-contact individuals, along with 150 European glass beads, 298 metal beads, and a number of metal artifacts. The skeleton remains provide evidence of violent confrontations. The site also contains a mass burial of 77 people. Archaeologists interpreted this as an indication of an epidemic, which frequently followed contact with Europeans and the communicable diseases previously unknown in the Americas. As Deegan notes, however, quote, the question of introduced European disease and its impacts on Native American demography is one of the central, if unresolved, issues of the pre-settlement contact period, end quote. While some scholars argue that, quote, European disease epidemics initiated a chain of disruptions and depopulations in La Florida, others contend that epidemic disease was just a component of a complex and lengthy process of colonization that led to cultural changes and population loss, end quote.
And hoping to control the area, Spaniards moved from exploratory expeditions to a series of failed settlements. These included colonization efforts by Ponce de Leon in 1521, Lucas Vasquez de Ayon in 1526, and Tristan de Luna in 1559. Also, the French got involved with settlement efforts by René de Laudonnière in 1564.
Evidence of the two settlement attempts most rigorously sought by archaeologists were Tristan de Luna's efforts to establish a Spanish colony at what is now Pensacola and René de Laudonnière's establishment of Fort Caroline. Arriving in 1559 with 1,500 colonists and 11 ships, Luna's colonists were hit by a hurricane before supplies could be unloaded. All but three ships were destroyed, and the colonists were forced to withdraw to a Native American town on the Alabama River. The colony was abandoned in 1561. In 1992 and in 2006, archaeologists with the Florida Department of State and the University of West Florida discovered the remains of two of the ships near Emmanuel Point in Pensacola Bay. The ships yielded a wealth of information about ship construction, material culture, and shipboard life in the mid-16th century. In 1564, the French explorer, René de Laudonnière, established Fort Caroline at the mouth of the St. John's River, near what is today Mayport. The following year, the French were routed by Spanish forces under Pedro Menendez, and the fort was renamed Fort San Mateo. Several hundred Frenchmen escaped with Jean Ribault, who arrived with supplies almost simultaneously with Menendez. The French contingent was shipwrecked before it reached safety, and several hundred were executed by Menendez's orders. Despite repeated efforts, no physical evidence of the Fort Caroline settlement had been found. Deegan points to the dramatic changes in coastal and estuarine morphology and modern development to explain the failure to locate physical artifacts.
And Connie, the most successful colonization effort remains with us today as the oldest continuously occupied European city in North America, St. Augustine. It wasn't a given that the colony would survive and had a short life at two other nearby sites before ending at the current location in 1572.
Pedro Menendez arrived with 800 soldiers, sailors, and civilians in 1565. He established settlement at a Timucua village on the coast that was in close proximity to French Fort Caroline. Once Menendez's forces defeated the French, 250 Spanish soldiers were garrisoned there. Within months, Menendez dealt with a mutiny among the soldiers at what was now Fort San Mateo and a rebellion by the Timucua. Once the mutinies were quelled, Menendez relocated St. Augustine to Anastasia Island on the east side of Matanzas Bay. The colony was reinforced by the arrival of 1,500 new colonists in 1566. Following the pacification of the Timucua, St. Augustine was moved to its present location in 1572. Long-term archaeological excavations have uncovered considerable evidence of Spanish and indigenous life in the 16th century St. Augustine. Physical evidence of Spanish housing for both civilians and soldiers, as well as Timucuan structures, have been excavated at the first and third sites of the town. Thousands of artifacts, including pottery, lead, shot, nails, buttons, and beads, have been unearthed. Analysis of food remains indicate the colonists lived on a diet of local fish, shellfish, and plant foods, including acorns and greenbrier root. Later 16th century evidence includes a pot kiln that was used to burn oyster shells to produce lime for construction activities. Street layout, a Christian cemetery, walled gardens, and barrel wells depict a growing Spanish colony at St. Augustine. There is also evidence that indigenous foods and culture were soon incorporated into the life of townspeople. From the earliest days, Spanish soldiers married Native American women. One effect of those marriages could be seen in kitchens. Food preparation processes used in Spanish kitchens were replaced with unmodified Native American pots for cooking and storage. But as Deegan notes, quote, serving and tableware remain nearly exclusively European in origin and appearance, end quote. In 1586, St. Augustine was burned during a raid by the English privateer Francis Drake. In the same year, Spanish authorities decided to abandon the northern town of St. Helena, which had served as the capital of La Florida, and consolidate the settlements in St. Augustine.
Menendez was also responsible for the founding of at least 8 military outposts throughout peninsular Florida, two of them, Tequesta in present-day Miami and Tocobaga in the Tampa Bay region, were also sites of short-lived Jesuit missions.
Little archaeological evidence has been found for the two Jesuit mission sites. In recent decades, renewed interest in Franciscan mission sites have produced evidence of their missionary efforts that began in 1587. Mission Nombre de Dios in St. Augustine, 1587 to 1763, was perhaps the first Franciscan mission in Florida. It served as settlement of already largely Christian Timucuan people. First excavated in 1934 by Roy Dixon, the site yielded 112 burials that largely followed Catholic traditions, but also included some incorporation of traditional Native American burial practices. At the site of Santa Catalina de Guale, Decades of systematic excavation have produced detailed information about early Franciscan mission architecture and building construction, organization of space, diet, material culture, and economic strategies. The most remarkable aspect of this work was the excavation of the Wattle and Daub Church itself, in which more than 400 native people were buried with an extraordinary array of grave goods. The lives of Kwale people have been studied through bioarchaeology, tree ring data, isotope analysis, and archaeological settlement studies. This interdisciplinary work shows that coastal Kwale people relied on corn in their diets and were, in general, sedentary. As Deacon observed, what started as studies of Spanish exploration and colonization has developed into scholarly examination of, quote, indigenous social and political dynamics, population movements related to shifting power structures, ecological changes, and the emergence of new ethnic identities among Native American groups during the 16th century, end quote. Deegan concludes that, quote, at the end of the 16th century, the Spanish presence in La Florida was much reduced, and there was debate over whether the colony should even exist. It was, however, on the brink of a major expansion of missions, garrisons, and ranches in the hinterland, and entry into a new international arena of conflict in the 17th century. That, she says, is another story.
And it's a story we'll explore another time. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. The Battle of Camp Monroe took place near present-day Sanford during the Second Seminole War. Jeremy Gottschalk takes us to a reenactment of the battle.
All right, so Flint's not sharp enough. That was the problem. Now, can you imagine having to do that with a bunch of Seminoles shooting at you?
The Sanford Museum and the Museum of Seminole County History recently hosted a reenactment of the Battle of Camp Monroe at Fort Mellon Park in Sanford. The site of the original location, February 8, 1837, a force of Seminole Indians led by King Philip attacked the camp. The event was free and open to the public, with downtown residents easily able to access the camp setup. Reenactors demonstrated 1,800 U.S. soldier and Seminole life while educating on topics such as the causes of the war, Seminole culture such as crafting arrowheads, camp cooking techniques, medical practices of the time, and early firearms demonstrations.
Getting them to interact and even perform it. For example, another thing is that I have a tongue depressor, you know, to pull down so they could see into the tonsils. They would line up the soldiers, they would have their tongues out, and they would go one by one. And of course, they're not wiping it down. They didn't believe in bacteria. And so I have the people line up, tongues out, you know, I don't actually put it on their tongues, obviously. And you go one by one and you can see their reaction, realizing what I'm doing. And having them come to that conclusion rather than me telling them is amazing.
I am the wife and I am the new home and I am a permanent settling force in this area. So when you hear of Indians, and it's not saying, you know, they're good guys or bad guys, war is just hell in general. What I'm saying is when they kill the women and children, it's not because they're barbarous, it is because I'm an occupying force.
Well, my name is Crystal Show, and I've actually been doing historical reenactment for about 20 years, give or take. I did do bacon this morning. I was going to do a little bit of a stew because I cook over the campfire. It's what I do, and it's a real easy thing. I like to tell people that the nursery rhyme with peas porridge hot, peas porridge cold, peas porridge in the pot 9 days old. It's actually true. You would start a pot going, and then over the course of about a week or two, you would just keep adding stuff in because you would eat some out, add some more in, and it would just keep rolling and rolling and rolling. There are historical references to people who had pots going for literally months at a time.
Museum of Seminole County History Museum Coordinator Bennett Lloyd discusses the importance of living history.
So living history is a way that we can engage all of our senses in trying to experience the past. It's a way we can develop empathy for people who we are disconnected from by, you know, decades or even centuries. It is a fun way to engage with the smells, the tastes, the sounds that are unlike anything you could just read in a text and imagine on your own. We acknowledge fully that what we have is never going to be perfect, but history is not a collection of facts that we know to be true. It's our best interpretation of the evidence that we have. It's our responsibility as historians to try and put that together as best we can.
Noah Windwalker Herrera is an Apache Lipan heritage and draws a comparison between his sharing of the Seminole culture and his own.
Just kind of building up Seminole camp. Like, I made my moccasins. These are Seminole style. I have been learning the history probably like two years now. But I would say the similarities I've seen with the Seminoles and the Lipan Apache is like, we were like resilient the same way the Seminoles were. We never gave up. We fought our battles hard until there was really nothing left to fight for. And then once the Indian policy kind of wiped out a lot of community, cultural, trade routes and stuff, it was really, there was no other solution to either basically, what's the word, like absorb with the Americans or don't exist, you know?
On Saturday, reenactors took positions of the battle against picket sightings and log placements as speakers read the diaries and written accounts from both soldiers and Seminoles. Onlookers observed the fall of Captain Charles Mellon, whose bravery would be noted in accounts and later earn the new fort its name, as well as the small pier town that would spring up after of Mellonville, to what would become present-day Sanford, Florida.
He lay behind a tree, and as the officer passed a gap in the work, shouting to his men, fired, and saw him fall.
Living history is important because it is our roots and gives us an idea of where we've come from, allows us to process and do better in the future, as in the old axiom, those who don't know the past are doomed to repeat it.
I feel great about it. I think it's awesome.
For Florida Frontiers, this is Jeremy Gottschalk.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook at Florida Historical Society. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and this week, Jeremy Gottschalk. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.